It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Beijing Olympics are less than 2 weeks away. For activists, the Olympics were a chance when China was at its most sensitive to push the country on Darfur, Tibet, human rights. We'll look at where China has moved under that pressure, where it hasn't, and what may come next. This hour, On Point, Olympic leverage and what it's wrought with China. Joining me first today from Beijing is Melinda Liu, Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. She writes the Countdown to Beijing blog at Newsweek.com. She opened Newsweek's Beijing bureau in 1980. Melinda Liu, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We'll go to pressure and consequences, but first, what about the general prep for the games? Give us the big picture, Melinda. What's going on right now?
Well, today the big news is that the big picture is very murky and very smoggy. As people almost all around the world know, pollution is a really big problem, and it continues to be a problem. There were hopes that perhaps the July smog and rain and haze would start clearing, but today was really bad.
Have athletes begun to arrive yet for the games, Linda?
Yes, they have. They've begun to arrive. I take it some are sort of appalled by what they found in terms of the pollution. But the good news is that the physical facilities, the hardware, seems to have come together magnificently. I was at the media center. The architecture is, you know, very grandiose. Mm. Lots of spaces, lots of, technology there. We have already seen... we've had a bit of an advanced taste of some of the tensions that might arise, a bit of a scuffle between police and predominantly Hong Kong media, but other international media as well. The journalists were simply trying to cover, you know, huge numbers of Chinese attempting to buy some of the last lots of Olympic tickets, if you can believe that. It turned into a bit of a chaotic scene, which ended up with... an altercation between police and journalists. One policeman ended up in the hospital after being kicked in the groin.
Ouch. What about attendance? Is it a sold-out Olympics? Do we know yet? And is most of the... What percentage of the attendees will be from outside China?
I don't know the exact percentage of domestic Chinese versus foreigners. But yes, the news is that some of the most popular venues are completely sold out. As people probably know, the level of popularity for these games among Chinese is very high, has always been high. And that's one of the reasons there was such a chaotic scene at the ticket-selling venue, because people were literally crying that they couldn't get the tickets that they'd hoped to be able to procure.
Linda, just a few months ago, when the torch was making its way through Europe, especially in London and Paris, there were scenes of protest and everything seemed really just reeling. Has China found its feet again in terms of the presentation of the Olympics to the world? Is it back on an even keel now, just days before the opening?
I don't think you could say that China's on an even keel, because I think this whole year has been unusually dynamic. Basically, this is a work in progress, a very dynamic situation. I think the very grim and depressing scenes that you mentioned that we saw in April, March and April and May, maybe, were then partly compensated for by another unexpected event, which was this massive earthquake in Sichuan, which actually, for a time, was a bit of a positive news story in that the country pulled together. There was an amazing outpouring of volunteerism from the grassroots in China. And for at least several weeks, I would say. The government and the international media and the domestic media were pretty much more or less on the same page.
And turning to the issue of activists, human rights, expectations around these Olympics, first at the granular level, we had this announcement from China late last week that it will set aside zones for protest during the Olympic Games. What are those? Where are those? And do people expect Chinese protesters to come out in Beijing while the Games are on?
I think they'll try. I think the designation of these three protest pens, as we call them, they're in public parks, is an acknowledgement that there were going to be attempts at protest no matter what was going on and no matter how many security personnel you throw out there. So in a way, this is a good sign, at least acknowledging that it's okay to protest. I think what remains to be seen is how many Chinese will be able to protest, given that you not only are there places now, but there's also a procedure, as I understand it, you have to actually apply. And then there are, topics that legal protests cannot touch, so-called national security topics, which again would relate to issues like, some of the slogans put out by the Free Tibet activists, that sort of thing. I don't expect those guys to be getting protest permits anytime soon.
Chinese law, we read, prohibits protests that are deemed harmful to national unity and social stability. That could be interpreted pretty broadly. We'll hear in a moment from people who have been right in the thick of it, Melinda, but you've been in Beijing a long time. You know there were expectations or hopes of change leveraged by the Olympics. Do you see China as having changed on the major fronts where expectations were raised, or at least where people had hopes internationally in the long run up to these Beijing Games?
I see some signs of change right now, but I don't know if we're at the end of the process. In other words, I think in terms of this hoped for political change, we're talking about a process and not a single event. I think the whole act of wanting the Olympics, getting the Olympics, preparing for the Olympics, and then holding the Olympics, and then recovering from the hangover of the Olympics, I think that whole process probably we will have seen, history will deem that to have been some sort of catalyst for change. Right now we're in the middle of it, and even though I see some things, both positive and negative, I don't think we're at the final stage yet.
Let's talk to a couple of people who have been right in the thick of all that for a long time. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Eric Reeves. He's been at the center of a global campaign against China's policy on Darfur and Sudan, labeled the Beijing Olympics the Genocide Olympics. He's author of A Long Day's Dying, Critical Moments in the Darfur Genocide. Eric Reeves, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from New York, Jerome Cohen, one of the world's top authorities on China's legal system and Chinese human rights. He's a professor at New York University School of Law, a senior fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Jerome Cohen, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Eric Reeves, first to you. You've been a big campaigner on Sudan and Darfur for a long time. China, of course, is right in the midst of that as a major arms supplier and with major commercial and oil relations with Sudan. Have you got the results you hoped for when you began to see the Beijing Olympics as an event that might leverage change from China?
No, we haven't. The situation on the ground in Darfur remains appalling. Insecurity continues to deteriorate, and the National Islamic Front, National Congress Party in Khartoum, remains as obdurate and defiant and brutal as ever. That said, China's response to the Darfur crisis has changed significantly. And we have to ask, as we always do looking at Darfur, how much worse would things have been without advocacy efforts? When major advocacy began in 2004 to coalesce around the acute humanitarian needs, we saw a breakthrough that would not have been accomplished without Darfur advocacy, and the world's largest humanitarian operation began really in July 2004. I think the question to ask about Darfur now is what could have happened had not China leaned, as it clearly did, on Khartoum. leaned in a way that prevented the regime from executing a final solution, which it can do at any point. It can make insecurity simply intolerable for humanitarians. That has not happened, so perhaps that's the glass half full.
We'll look at the details on Darfur and Sudan. Jerome Cohen, what about within China? There were promises, explicit and implicit, made about what China would do in the run-up to the Olympics. Do you see progress on the front of what legal process that you've been most concerned with?
No, unfortunately, Tom, it seems to be working out in a counterproductive way. One had hoped that in order to show off China's progress, there would have been a significant improvement in the legal and human rights situation. But the leadership is so profoundly obsessed with the need to demonstrate to the world what a harmonious society China is that, contrary to its promises, it has repressed many activities, that some of which had been going on before. This period in recent months has proved to be more repressive, not less repressive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the home stretch to the Beijing Olympics, we are looking this hour at what happened to the campaigns to leverage China on Darfur, Tibet, human rights, and more through the Games. We've been joined from Beijing by Melinda Liu, Newsweek bureau chief there in Beijing. She writes the Countdown to Beijing blog at Newsweek.com, anticipating the Olympics. From New York, Jerome Cohen is with us, one of the world's top authorities on China's legal system and human rights there, professor at NYU Law School. And from Amherst, Massachusetts, Eric Reeves joins us. He's been at the center of a campaign against China's Darfur policy, labeling part of the groups that labeled the Beijing Olympics the Genocide Olympics. Melinda, what do we know about what promises China made in getting the Olympics for Beijing? Back in the spring, when things were rough around the torch, we had the head of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, Jacques Rogge, talking about that. He said, you know, we asked China to respect this moral engagement, and alluding to promises made, I guess, on the human rights front.
Right. Well, there were explicit promises and then there were expectations. And I think the key thing here is that if you're an Olympic host nation, the world has some very fundamental expectations of how you're going to behave and how you're going to hold this event. And then you have some very specific things that Chinese authorities have said, okay, let's just get very bare bones here. The promises that Chinese authorities made, not all of them have been delivered upon. One that strikes home very, very, very much for foreign correspondents covering this event is the promise that foreign media will be free to report when they come to China, or if, you know, indeed some of them are already here. And of course, as we know now, there are still large chunks of the country that are basically not open to foreign media reporting, specifically Tibet, but also Tibetan communities in other Chinese provinces. And even recently, a live broadcast by a German TV crew from the Great Wall was interfered with by authorities who tried to stop it. This is not what people expected. And just a few days ago, like I said, there was this a physical scuffle between journalists. That's, I think, a sort of a, you know, a foretaste of the sorts of misunderstandings. Clearly, Chinese authorities also have their expectations of what foreign visitors and foreign journalists are going to be like when they come, and I think there's going to be a clash of expectations here.
So foreign press freedom, one issue, maybe how foreign visitors behave when they're in China for the Olympics. Were there broader promises made? Is it known, Melinda? Was Beijing willing to make broader promises about its internal justice system, about its foreign policy, or were those just hoped for, presumed?
There were some very sweeping statements made, and then I think everyone presumed and possibly, you know, a good dose of wishful thinking there as well. I mean, statements like, I'm paraphrasing here, but, even though the Olympics is a sports event, it will have a positive impact on human rights, on culture, on education, you know, all that sort of thing. These are the sorts of things that Chinese officials were saying. Of course, they were saying it because they wanted to win this bid very badly. And I think a huge leap of faith was taken to give it to China. Having said that, there have been some positive movements, but certainly not what people anticipate, you know, not enough. For foreign correspondents, again, the most obvious move forward was a change in the regulations, which made it a sort of a liberalization of the rules for foreign journalists to report here. Having said that, for Chinese media, things have gone backwards. And indeed, we're seeing crackdowns of talk about micromanagement. I mean, there is some kind of regulation that says a group of more than five people is an illegal gathering. So, you know, kids in my residential compound who are trying to play cricket are told they can't do it if there's more than five of them. Now, that's sort of ridiculous.
Hmm. Jerome Cohen in New York, you followed China for a long time. The last time we spoke with you, we were sitting with you in Shanghai. What about this very serious game, I guess, of promises and expectations on the issues that you care most about? Did you see promises that you expected might explicitly, materially affect those fronts? Did you have expectations that have or have not been met?
Well, as Melinda says, general statements were made, including those about improving the human rights situation. They wisely didn't get too specific, but they did create expectations. And those expectations, as I indicated earlier, have certainly not been vindicated. And in some respects, the situation has gone backwards. It's very unfortunate, just to talk about journalists, it's not only a question of getting access to territory, but to people. And if the people are instructed that they should beware of foreign journalists, and many refuse to talk to them, that's another aspect that wasn't explicitly dealt with, and it's one of the ways the regime accommodates whatever concessions it makes, at least as a matter of form, to the journalistic and broader human rights community. In the legal system, China is at a stalemate. It's imported a lot of Western values, Western forms, structures, courts, judges, prosecutors, but it hasn't really been able to move forward in recent years. It's stuck. On the one hand, 4 days a week, the leadership tells the people, yes, we're bringing you all these freedoms and democracy. 3 days a week, it's saying, don't believe all this Western stuff. We're still China. We have our special conditions. And don't expect a Western-style legal system. So there are all kinds of contradictions to which the leadership itself has contributed quite a lot, including putting human rights in the Constitution. So we're witnessing the Olympics coming at a very crucial time in China's development. My hope is, even though the immediate has brought a greater repression of human rights, civil liberties, due process of law, that the tensions created and the exposure to the world of the nature of the Chinese political system and its failure to match China's huge social and economic progress will ultimately lead to more pressure for reform. But some leader has to take this on and make this his thing. And we have yet to see, although we now have the first law school graduate in the Politburo Standing Committee, we have yet to see any leader say, I know the people want better human rights. I know they want more secure legal environment. I know they want action from the courts to protect their rights, and I'm going to lead the way. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people in China have made this clear to the leadership. They're trying to bubble up from the bottom all these pressures to improve the legal system. But no leader has yet taken this on. They're too obsessed with repression, harmony, stability. And they don't see real stability in a country comes from having adequate legal institutions that can handle people's grievances and not force them to go out in the street in order to be heard.
We'll look more at those domestic issues. Eric Reeves, what about on the Sudan front? I mean, you had this very tough language out there in the world, the genocide Olympics, and we're making specific demands on China, hoping for specific steps. Can you describe some of what China has and has not done around Sudan and Darfur during the many months now of that campaign?
It's important to recognize that as gloomy as the situation is on the ground, China has done a fair bit, more in many ways than anyone thought possible a year ago.
Lay it out for us.
Several times, China has said publicly to the Khartoum regime, you must show more flexibility in accommodating the UN peacekeeping force. That's really unprecedented language for China speaking about a foreign hotspot. Privately, I know from highly authoritative sources, the language has been tougher yet. A year ago, almost exactly today, China voted for UN Security Council Resolution 1769, which authorized the UN peacekeeping force that is, in fact, failing. But it's failing not simply because of China, but because of Khartoum's recalcitrance and a lack of international support. Very recently, China, in June, supported a unanimous Security Council resolution, non-binding but nonetheless significant, supporting the work of the International Criminal Court in its investigation of atrocity crimes in Darfur. Well, on July 14th, Luis Moreno Ocampo, the ICC prosecutor, announced that genocide charges had been brought against the Khartoum regime president, Omar al-Bashir. Khartoum's support of the ICC, which it has not ratified the Rome statute, is
International quite Criminal
significant.
Court. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You say Khartoum's support or Beijing's? I mean, what's Beijing's position?
Neither support. Beijing refuses to support the ICC in principle, refuses to ratify the Rome Statute, but nonetheless, like the United States, which also does not support the ICC, has not ratified the Rome Statute, has found that in the case of Darfur, it's politically too costly to vote against the ICC. And so we have now an extraordinary situation in which, in part because of China's acquiescence, purchased in large measure because of an unwillingness on the part of Beijing to be seen as an obstructionist force in Darfur, Beijing has actually voted for the ICC or voted to support its investigation of atrocity crimes. And I'd say going forward—
In Sudan in particular? In other words, they're supporting the pressure that the ICC is putting on Bashir, head of Sudan?
Well, in June of this year, they voted for a UN Security Council resolution that explicitly supported ICC, International Criminal Court, investigations of atrocity crimes, including genocide, in Darfur. And this has resulted in the president of Sudan being indicted. And in a few months, sooner, we'll see an arrest warrant issued. This provides the opportunity, I believe, for enormous leverage with the regime. Many fear, rightly, that Khartoum may lash out if the president, Bashir, is indicted. But I believe that the regime is now actually working overtime to improve its international standing. It's cultivating the Arab League, the African Union, in ways that it simply would not have had to in the absence of an ICC referral.
You're prepared to give some credit to China for that change in tone from Khartoum?
I think the fact that China didn't abstain, as they did when the UN Security Council referred the matter to the International Criminal Court in March of 2005, that the fact that in June 2008, China actually voted affirmatively for a resolution supporting the ICC is very significant, as is the fact that it voted for, positively, the resolution authorizing the UN peacekeeping force known as UNAMID. The fact that it publicly urged flexibility on Khartoum in accepting this peacekeeping force, and that we know behind the scenes there's been greater pressure. Yet this hasn't translated into a resolution of the Darfur conflict, far from it, but it has produced actions on the part of Beijing that a year ago, year and a half ago, people were saying, this is impossible. We're scoffing at the whole notion that China could be moved in any of these ways.
Let's begin to turn to our listeners. A caller from Toronto, Canada, Jeff. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'd like to make 3 points. First being, I don't think we can expect China to change its behavior towards these issues on human rights. The Soviet Union, when they had the games in 1980 in Moscow, were supposed to withdraw from Afghanistan. They didn't. They stayed for a long time. China is in Tibet. It's probably there to stay for a long time. The second point is, as far as human rights and trade goes, the Europeans, the Americans, and Canadians have a tremendous amount of commercial and trade interest in China. So the government is receiving that support in terms of commercial support from the Western powers. So it will not budge on human rights. And the third point about the green zones is that's a kind of a trap to get protesters into one area where they can be rounded up and then taken away. So it's a kind of a deceptive term.
Yeah, it does seem like it might take a lot of courage to step in there in Beijing and wherever, Purple Bamboo Park or wherever it is to protest. But Melinda Liu, in Beijing, what about this issue of, I mean, China has such enormous international economic relations now and trade. Has all of that, all the money flowing in and out of China, and largely in, but has that overwhelmed the Olympics as a point of leverage here? Is money speaking louder in trade and economic interaction terms than the more misty ideals of the Olympic Games?
Well, certainly the support of the Olympic sponsors, was sort of a critical factor during that very contentious period of the torch relay going through Europe and San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, of course, the sponsors themselves must have been having conniption fits during that whole time. Things have calmed down since then. I think, again, the tragedy of the earthquake in Sichuan, 70,000 people killed, 500 million Chinese homeless, that's sort of sympathy welled up out of the international community and from the Chinese themselves, I think has acted as a counterweight to those very negative emotions that were roiled up earlier. Having said that, yes, of course, we're sitting here, watching a huge, very powerful country with a tarnished human rights record that the whole world would hope could be improved significantly by the holding of the Olympics, hand in hand with the corporate giants of, around the globe. And it's a powerful combination, and it's also why everyone's watching, because this is also the time for China's critics to come forward and use that spotlight to highlight their causes.
Melinda Liu in Beijing, please stand by. Jerome Cohen, Eric Ries will look at how effective that has and has not been, China in the Olympics. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. On the home stretch to the Beijing Olympics, we are looking at what happened to the campaigns to leverage China on Darfur, Tibet, human rights, and more through the Games. We've been joined from Beijing by Melinda Liu, Newsweek magazine bureau chief there, from New York by Jerome Cohen, a leading authority on China's legal system and human rights inside the country, and from Amherst, Massachusetts by Eric Reeves, who's been at the center of a campaign to change Chinese policy on Sudan and Darfur. On Friday, in Aspen, Colorado, Republican presidential candidate John McCain met with the Dalai Lama, had this to say on Tibet.
I urge the Chinese government to release Tibetan political prisoners, account for Tibetans who have, quote, disappeared since the protests in March, and engage in meaningful dialogue and genuine autonomy for Tibet.
John McCain with the Dalai Lama on the eve of the Olympics. Let's take a call from Fort Dodge, Iowa. Joe, you're on the air. What do you think, Joe?
And first, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I just have a question for the people, your experts there today. Don't the Olympics give us our best opportunity to engage countries with repressive human rights records, countries that we feel that we have problems with, totalitarian regimes? You know, I just look at one of your guests talked about the process of change, and I thought it was interesting. Just before you talked to me, you run John McCain talking about Tibet. Was John McCain is talking about Tibet. He's not talking about Burma. He's not talking about other places that we don't have the Olympics going on at. And even your show today, we're talking about China. We're putting the spotlight on China.
But Joe, is your point that that we should engage, with a big smile on everybody's face, that be easier on China, or engage as in be tougher on China?
No, I'm saying that we are engaging China right now with having the Olympics in China. We've got the spotlight on China right now, and not necessarily with a smile on our face.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at the history, the Olympics give the human race a marvelous opportunity, and I know that sounds idealistic, but we're talking about the Olympics. 1936, Jesse Owens, that he put a dent in some of Hitler's theories about the Aryan race, didn't he?
Right, but that was also, of course, the Olympics in Berlin, Adolf Hitler's Berlin, that proved to be kind of a lasting embarrassment for the Olympic Committee because they let Hitler have the Olympics.
And Hitler had Jesse Owens. And, you know, you look at every Olympics, 1980, one of your callers talked about 1980, the USSR not getting out of Afghanistan. Well, we didn't engage the USSR. We didn't send our Olympians. So are we to blame there? Would you look at that and say, United States, you know, we have to look at ourselves and say, we didn't take the opportunity. You know, this is a chance, and your show today proves it, that regardless of whether you're smiling, whether you're saying that, you know, the Chinese have had a positive impact on Darfur, which is debatable. You know, and we live in such a small world today, and I don't want to take up all your time, but, you know, Fiat has dropped an ad where Richard Gere is talking to a Tibetan monk because they're worried about what the impact of that ad, which was not shown in China, was only shown in Europe, but we've got the Internet today. And I know the Chinese lack access to the Internet, but you have to look at how are we going to engage the Irans, the Chinas, the places where we've got totalitarian regimes. How are you going to do it without something like the Olympics? Do you have a better idea?
Right. Joe, thanks for your call. Jerome Cohen, how about it at this level of, look, the Olympic spotlight, it is gigantic, and China has made it all the bigger by its huge work to remake so much of itself and to bring these in. Given all that, do you think there's been a proportionate response from China to the world's concerns? Do you not worry about it, Jerome Cohen, because these things unfold in the fullness of time? The Olympics is 1 year, but maybe as in Tokyo years ago, as in Seoul, South Korea years ago, maybe this sets a new tone? Or do you think that China is so big, increasingly so rich, that it can kind of brush off, blow by the Olympics?
No, I don't think the Chinese leadership thinks that either. That's why they're so obsessed with it. And let's correct a misimpression. By being critical of the way some of the things have worked out, like the promises to expand human rights, it doesn't mean that I'm against having the Olympics in China.
Mm-hmm.
I was against the original attempt to bring the Olympics in China because it came so soon after the 1989 June 4th Tiananmen tragedy, the slaughter of many, many hundreds of people that China has never yet fully accounted for. But I was for the second attempt, and I think on balance, it is good to have the Olympics, even if, as I said, in the short run, certain things have not been fulfilled and have proved a disappointment. But it's good. The question is, what does engagement mean? We've been engaging with China in many, many ways, and it's had beneficial effects for all of us, including the business community. I don't want to cast the business community as an evil force here. That isn't correct. But they're limited in what they can do. But what we're seeing here is a demonstration before the world for the Chinese leadership that will increase their attention to political legal reform. Some reform is going on now. Recently, one of the provinces just enacted a freedom of information regulation. With all its imperfections, this shows there's pressure to create greater transparency, even in a communist authoritarian regime. They can't control events. They have to have better institutions to handle them. The earthquake demonstrated that. After the earthquake, hundreds and hundreds of parents have been seeking justice. For them, justice means a true investigation of why did those schools collapse, killing so many children. They want to go to court. They want to hire lawyers. They want to be able to petition. They want to protest. And when all this now in recent weeks has been frustrated, the leadership, which is led by very sensitive, intelligent people, Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, he knows that they can't get by much longer with this kind of repression. And I think the Olympics have demonstrated that, not only to the leadership, but to the world. So on balance, in the middle range and long range, certainly having the Olympics is a good thing. And in general, it's good to have athletes of the world come together. And there's too much hype, but that's always been the case. But I'm not against the Olympics. I'm for further political legal process for China's own good.
Let's take
That's the way to get real harmony and stability.
From Lowell, Massachusetts, Bill, you're on the air, Bill.
Hi. I had a couple of just observations. My family was actually in China from 1880. My great-grandfather was one of the founders of Shutao University.
A missionary there, then, maybe.
And his sons and grandsons were all doctors, born and raised in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that my uncle pointed out to me when he was able to go back, we were all banned after the revolution, he was amazed at the lack of beggars and starving people in the streets. And he was able to get away from his government minders because he spoke the local dialect fluently. And he came back. He said, "I'll never say another bad thing about Mao."
Though, of course, there were times under Mao when many, many, many people starved.
Absolutely, but the routine daily death by starvation and disease wasn't there. And this is huge progress. People, I think, forget. And I was very opposed to the Olympics going to China. I think it was a terrible decision, but. The Chinese government is faced with an extraordinarily difficult balancing act between 3,000 years of history of peasant revolutions, which it is terrified of, and a desperate need to modernize the economy. And I think what has to happen is a similar balancing act on the part of the rest of the world, where we have to keep that pressure on about human rights. But understanding that what emerges will be a Chinese version, they're not going to enact a United States style democracy. That will never happen in China.
Bill, let us take that perspective to Beijing and Melinda Liu, if I may. Melinda, how does that sound, sitting where you do, seeing what you see there? Of course, on one hand, China has done something quite miraculous, an enormous effort in lifting the country up in a relatively small number of decades from real destitution to where it is right now. On the other, you know, people around the world may wonder how much understanding to extend, how much slack to cut China on the human rights front. Our caller says, you know, be careful, don't push too hard, be understanding. Does that seem like a reasonable global view, Melinda? Or, you know, when you're inside China, does that seem too empathetic?
You have to understand, I'm a journalist,
mm-hmm.
So I'll just tell you like how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
China always wants to be treated as something special, not just any big country, not just any developing country, not just any Asian country. There's always something special about China. It is the celestial kingdom, okay? And they have been bashing foreigners over the head with this specialness for centuries. And, you know, we've had socialism with Chinese characteristics, which meant you could be a robber baron, but you could still be a communist. And we've seen, you know, democracy with Chinese characteristics, which means that, you know, you can vote at the grassroots, at the very lowest grassroots level, but you can't, you know, at the township level where you have real budgets and money and power.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is such a thing as universal human rights. I think the Chinese would love to make the world understand that Chinese people are just made differently from everyone else, so that they have to be treated in a certain way, and if they were treated any other way, you know, the whole place would explode. Mm. Okay, China's got a lot of history. Yes, that is what makes China, China. But every country has had history. Every country can learn something from other countries. No, you can't. You can't lift the American system, you know, from the United States and transplant it into China. No, but you know, this specialness that Chinese authorities would love to have people buy into. I think it's not only an excuse. I also think it doesn't do them justice. I actually think we should give more credit to the Chinese people, that they don't need to be protected. You know, what we're talking about is as a form of intellectual protectionism, really.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think you can expose them to ideas. I think you can let them go overseas in greater and greater numbers, as we've seen them do. And you can let them compete in the marketplace of ideas. You know, I mean, in 1980, which is, you know, when I first started working here and mm-hmm. living here, there were questions about whether Chinese could be capitalist. And I don't think we need to ask that question anymore today. And I think by the same token, you know, instead of trying to protect this, you know, infant nation, I think you could say, okay, you know, they've proved that they can, you know, compete economically in the marketplace. Let's see if they can compete intellectually as well.
Jerome Cohen, big infant, if China is an infant nation. I wonder about the impact of the Olympics themselves and whether inside China it's been a net plus for human rights. I mean, we read about 3 million of Beijing's residents being evicted, moved out for the reconstruction of the city. Maybe $200 billion spent on that project, which Pico Iyer writes in Time magazine this week is 300 times as much as its entire annual spending on rural health care in 2006. I mean, is the footprint of the Olympics itself a kind of, yes, it's a celebration. Yes, it will bring glory. And yes, a lot of Chinese have worked hard for it. But is it a kind of imposition on human rights at the same time, Jerome?
Well, there's a lot of urban reconstruction. I think the people who've been asked to pay the price for this are unfairly suffering and have been, in some cases at least, inadequately compensated. But everybody in China, regardless of his or her desires, preoccupations, dissatisfactions, seems to be feeling the nationalist pride to show the world that China has made very great accomplishments. Unfortunately, going with it is the rest of the package, that China is very limited in its freedoms and its legal system. It is still a highly dictatorial, authoritarian state where the police run the legal system. That's the reality. I just want to say a word about what Melinda said so eloquently. Mm-hmm. If you look at Taiwan, which is a Chinese community, if you look at South Korea, which is heavily influenced by the Buddhist and Confucian faiths of China and has many similar conditions to China, if you look at Japan, which similarly shares the East Asian Confucian cultural area traditions, these countries have all managed to have decent, relatively successful, quite democratic governments, with, of course, many of the problems that democratic governments, including our own, experience. But to say that the masses of the Chinese people aren't up to developing that kind of political legal system is really an insult to them, and they're being treated like infants by their leaders. And I think it's time for China to grow up, and the Olympics are a good time to demonstrate that.
Eric Reeves, you raised a tough banner in the run-up to these Olympics, the Genocide Olympics tag. Are you striking that banner now? Are you taking it down? Has China done enough for you on Sudan, despite the fact that it delivers most of the arms and takes so much economic interaction there? Are you striking those colors, bringing them down, Eric?
Not at all. And I think with the benefit of hindsight, to be sure, I myself regard it as deeply inappropriate that a nation so complicit in the Darfur genocide so responsible in so many ways for encouraging Khartoum's genocidal behavior. China is no appropriate host at this moment in history for hosting of the Olympic Games. But I think the real point to make here is that the long-term effect of the Genocide Olympics campaign, formalized as Dream for Darfur, is that the connection between China, Sudan, and Darfur is clear in a way that it never would have been without this campaign. We're seeing developments, for example, a very recent BBC documentary in which I served as a consultant was able to pinpoint Chinese weapon transfers into Darfur in ways that make clear this genocidal complicity. So I think once the banner is up, I think it needs to stay up until genocide in Darfur ends.
Well, the big celebration, the big to-do, about to unfold in Beijing in just a little more than a week now. We're grateful to each of you for some perspective behind and around it as that happens. Melinda Liu in Beijing, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Jerome Cohen in New York, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Eric Reeves in Amherst, Massachusetts, thank you for your time.
And thank you, Tom.
Thanks, listeners. Join us again. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.